Put knowledge to work and grow your business with CIT. From transportation to healthcare to manufacturing, CIT offers commercial lending, leasing, and treasury management services for small and middle market businesses. Learn more at CIT.com. Put knowledge to work.
Welcome to Deal of the Week, Bloomberg's podcast on the world of mergers, acquisitions, and investments. I'm your host, Alex Sherman. Today's guest is Kate Ambrose. She's the president and executive director at the Latin American Private Equity and Venture Capital Association. Bit of a mouthful, but if you're thinking about looking outside of the U.S. for investment opportunities, you're going to love listening to her. She's got a great view of how Latin American investments are doing in countries like Mexico, Brazil, and Argentina. She has a really strong illustration of the differences between the countries and talks about how private investments differ from public ones. That's coming up, but first, it's time for this week's What's the Big Deal? And we turn to the world of exchanges. Bloomberg News reporter Matt Monks broke the news that Intercontinental Exchange, better known as ICE, is exploring an offer for the London Stock Exchange. The news comes just a week after the LSE said it was in merger talks with the German exchange, I'm going to test my German pronunciation here, Deutsche Börse, a deal that would create a $28 billion European exchange. And if that wasn't jumbled enough, the CME, which owns the Chicago Mercantile Exchange, is also considering a bid for the LSE. So to sort all this out, we bring in Matt Monks. Hi, Matt.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Thanks for joining us again. So the London Stock Exchange, why is this such a sought-after property?
You have to put it in the context of what's been going on in the exchange world in the last 5 to 10 years. Essentially, they've been consolidating to the point where there aren't many companies like the London Stock Exchange out there. It's one of two of the last remaining major exchanges in Europe. The other one is Deutsche Börse. And they're both still relatively bite-sized, at least in comparison to their larger competitors, ICE, ICE, Intercontinental Exchange, and CME Group. So basically, it's got two things going for it. It's a great name, great platform, and it's got scarcity value as one of the last two standing.
So broadly speaking, why have we been seeing all of these exchange mergers?
What it really comes down to is the fact that stock trading is not like it was in the past. It's mostly electronic these days. And what that has meant is a lot of upstarts, such as, you know, the high-frequency trader BATS, have come in and created a lot of new competition, taking market share away from some of the larger exchanges. Whenever businesses become less profitable, what do? They seek to scale up through acquisitions. You get synergies and you get diversification of products and geography.
And ICE owns the most notable stock exchange, correct? The New York Stock Exchange?
The New York Stock Exchange. And that's a reflection of the consolidation that's been going on. You've seen NASDAQ, OMX Group, among others.
So let's turn back to this particular deal, the London Stock Exchange. The word stock is in the name of the company, but is that the only thing the London Stock Exchange trades?
No, it's a batch of several different businesses that trade stocks, do trading derivatives, but also a bunch of things that help service that, like, you know, technology services, software that it licenses out to other exchanges. It's got a big clearing business, which is essentially, you know, they charge a fee for holding the actual security post-trade, and it's also in indexes.
So what are exactly exchanges these days? In other words, my conception of the New York Stock Exchange is still like the building in the financial district of New York where there are these traders and you see it in the background, particularly on CNBC. But clearly that's not what all of these things are. At least it doesn't sound like that based on what you're telling me now.
No, the New York Stock Exchange is the rare exception of a trading floor where people are actually doing trades face-to-face. Essentially, what are exchanges today? They're computers, and they are data centers. But the New York Stock Exchange is an outlier in that they still have people on the floor. I don't even know if it's necessary to tell you the truth.
Yeah, from what I've heard, it's more of a TV set than anything else, which is really interesting in a way because you would think that if for some reason the TV angle goes away, then what? Like, do they just disband the New York Stock Exchange? I mean, that's...
Yeah, I'm not going to say disband it, but a couple weeks ago we wrote about the Chicago Stock Exchange, which goes back to the 1800s, and they used to have a big trading floor of like 1,500 people. They don't anymore, actually. It's gone. They have, like 30 guys in New Jersey. That's what the Chicago Stock Exchange is. So yeah, it's conceivable potentially that happens with the New York Stock Exchange.
In fact, one of our partner podcasts, Oddlots, is actually doing an entire episode dedicated to floor trading and why floor trading has gone away. That episode will be out in a week or two. So anyways, back to this deal again. Are there regulatory issues around this deal?
Short answer, yes, absolutely. No matter who buys it, if ICE buys it, if Deutsche Börse, you know, goes forward, these things are going to be vetted to the yang. U.S. regulators, European Commission most likely, UK regulators, German regulators, any way you slice it, a lot of people are going to be taking a look at this on the regulatory front.
Is there sensitive data involved in exchanges? Is that why this will be looked at so closely?
It goes back to my understanding is exchanges tend to be nationalistic symbols. You know, the London Stock Exchange was started in like the 1600s. People, they have a special place in the heart of the country's financial systems. And I think that just generally creates a knee-jerk reaction when someone wants to go in and buy them. A couple years ago, Deutsche Börse actually tried to buy the New York Stock Exchange.
I remember that.
Yeah, Charles Schumer got involved, if I recall, and, you know, helped scuttle that deal. So just innately, there's something about exchanges that gets to the heart of the finance of these countries.
Right, right. So that instead of the Germans buying it, the Atlanta-based data center, ICE, bought the New York Stock Exchange. That's the American way. How does all this play out? In other words, is there a combination here that makes more sense to you, Matt, than any of the other ones?
My sense is that ICE, Intercontinental Exchange, has the firepower to pay up the most for LSE. LSE and Deutsche Börse, we don't know what the terms are yet, but it's going to conceivably be a merger of equals type deal, which tends to be low premium. So ICE has the firepower to do it. But what it's really going to come down to is London Stock Exchange shareholders. What do they want? Do they want to take the higher price, or do they want to take something that is going to better tie them to Europe? Do they take the money on the table, or they do something that's going to conceivably make the European financial system stronger? And so that's a long way of answering. We don't know yet.
Maybe there is some sort of nationalistic tie here if they choose Europe over the United States. Or maybe not, because, you know, if you've been following Brexit at all, it seems like possible that England doesn't want anything to do with the rest of Europe. So maybe they choose the United States over that. Very interesting. We'll continue to see how this all plays out. Bloomberg M&A reporter Matt Monks, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
And before we get to Kate, a word from our sponsor.
Put knowledge to work and grow your business with CIT. From transportation to healthcare to manufacturing, CIT offers commercial lending, leasing, and treasury management services for small and middle market businesses. Learn more at CIT.com. Put knowledge to work.
Our guest this week is Kate Ambrose, the President and Executive Director for the Latin America Private Equity and Venture Capital Association, to discuss Latin American private equity investing. Hi, Kate.
Hi, good to be here today. Thanks.
Thank you for joining us.
Thanks.
So let's start with, what exactly is your organization?
We are a nonprofit trade group. We have 180 member firms as of today, which includes everything from the world's largest global asset managers, KKR, Carlyle, Advent, Warburg Pincus, Bain, all the way through to venture funds and local private equity funds on the ground from Mexico to Argentina. We lobby on behalf of those firms in the region and interact with regulators on public policy issues, taxation of private equity and related issues. We produce proprietary data and a host of other activities.
And just for you personally, what led you to be interested in Latin American private equity?
Latin America was my area of interest all the way back to my undergraduate degree. I actually lived in Spain for many, many years as a journalist originally and followed Latin America and fell into the niche of Latin America private equity around 1999 when the first generation of investing was happening. I worked for The Economist for quite a few years and organized a conference on private equity investing in Latin America.
And then how did you transition to this organization from that?
I was actually working at a United Nations Commission on property rights, so it's not going to make a lot of sense, and got recruited in by somebody who remembered me. That was 2007, and it was the first time in my career that I was doing something that was focused exclusively on Latin America, and it was really a time that you could see that Latin America would be taking off as a market. We've grown from about 25 members then to, again, 180 members today.
So let's talk about the Latin American market. In the first half of 2015, I've got these stats in front of me, private equity fundraising reached $4.27 billion in Latin America, which was a new high since $4.9 billion in 2011. Was the second half of the year as good as the first half of the year now that we're in 2016.
Well, it's the perfect time to be having this conversation. We've actually just finalizing the numbers for a full year 2015. We haven't made them public yet, but we can see that we're going to be exceeding $7 billion. It's somewhere around $7.2 billion that was raised for Latin America private equity in all of 2015. The record year of fundraising for the region was actually 2014 at $10.4 billion. So we consider this to be quite a positive number. I mean, keep in mind the industries and the region are only so big, so we do see cycles. You can't see $10 billion raised every year. The managers need to put that money to work. So this is actually a pretty good showing for fundraising.
Although, if I'm doing my math right, that means that the second half of the year was fairly significantly lower than the first half of the year, right?
Yeah, I mean, I think, look, again, it's only so big of a market. In terms of the number of funds in the market, when we see one very large closing, that can drive. I believe that there was a large infrastructure fund from Patria, which is the only $1 billion-plus fund that closed last year that drove those fundraising numbers. In the past, in a really big fundraising year, it's the $1 billion funds that will get us to those peaks. In 2014, Advent International raised $2.1 billion, the largest fund ever raised for private equity in the region, and that contributed a lot to that record year. This past year was much more sub-$1 billion funds.
So let's talk about the macro picture in Latin America. I would imagine there are some listeners to this that don't follow Latin America that closely. But obviously, most people know about the big drop in oil prices, which clearly has a significant impact on Latin America. We've seen other commodity prices fall as well. So what is the confidence in Latin America right now from a private equity standpoint?
Well, I think the important thing is to distinguish among markets. So when we talk about private equity in the region, we're talking about Mexico, Brazil, Peru, Colombia, Chile as the main markets. And now Argentina is coming online in an interesting new way. The other countries, you know, occasionally you'll see a one-off transaction in a market or the expansion of a portfolio company into a country like Ecuador. But overwhelmingly, it's those countries where you see the activity concentrated. It's not a great time for emerging markets. No surprises there. We do see dramatic differences within countries within the region. So two positive stories today are Mexico. We see still an enormous amount of interest, obviously highly correlated with the U.S., very, very different sort of play investing in a country like Mexico than investing in a country like Brazil, which is not correlated to the U.S. and much more resource dependent. And Argentina had a really important election last year. They elected a very successful businessman who had run the city really well. And so a lot of excitement about what's going to be changing and the opportunities there. For a country like Brazil, they're in the midst of a severe economic and political crisis. But that does create opportunities for private equity investors as well.
And I would imagine, I mean, look, if you've invested in Brazil the past couple of years, you've gotten hammered. There's no question about it. Yeah, the markets are down. The currency has not done very well, certainly compared to the U.S. But if you're investing in private equity, you're A, shielded from the up and down public markets, and B, even though the currency issue is still one, you're investing for a much longer time horizon. I would think that private equity would benefit relative to public investments in countries that maybe are going through a tough time right now. Are you seeing that?
Absolutely. On the deal numbers for last year, we saw a fairly strong showing at about $6.5 billion that was invested pan-regionally, and more than half of that was in Brazil. So we definitely see managers still putting money to work in the Brazilian market. And I think the interesting thing is those private equity firms that have looked at Latin America or looked at Brazil, thought about getting into the market in the past and maybe just weren't sure if it was the right time, are moving now because their dollars are, the Brazilian real has devalued by 100%. So the opportunity to go into that market today and do interesting deals is great. CVC, the European private equity firm, opened an office in Brazil just a couple of months ago and made a really high profile hire in that market. And then we see other types of long-term investors such as sovereign wealth funds, GIC, Temasek have been very active. Canadian pension funds, CPPIB, opened an office in Brazil recently, has been doing some large transactions. So, yeah.
And in general, when we're talking about private equity, let's talk about Mexico and Brazil in particular. Are there certain sectors that the private equity money is going to? In other words, is it infrastructure? Is it consumer goods? What is it exactly that they're investing in?
taking a step back quickly to look at the cycle, since about 2007, we've been collecting data since 2008. An enormous part of the story has been this consumer play story that we've seen in other emerging markets as well, with an expanding middle class, enormous investments in healthcare, education, financial services, everything related to consumer credit. And then energy and natural resources is where people tend to think traditionally about Latin America. And there's also been quite a bit of activity there, and infrastructure as well. So those are all areas where we've seen international private equity firms playing in Latin America.
Can we get a little bit more specific sort of within the countries? In other words, you know, you brought up Argentina. They just had an election. Where is the money flow among private equity firms within Argentina right now?
Well, to be fair, Argentina is now completely countercyclical to the rest of the region and emerging markets. It's been untouched for investment for quite a few years now, when other emerging markets were booming, because they had a government in place that, among other things, has an enormous sovereign debt litigation to solve. It's not done yet. Hopefully, we're going to get there soon. The energy is a big part of the story in Argentina as well. In the Southern Cone, there's some oil fields to be exploited. And then agribusiness is a very big story in Argentina as well. I mean, they're just very strong on the natural resources side. Interestingly, technology is also a sector where we've seen very important investments in Latin America over the last few years. And Argentina has a very highly educated technology field, and has, in fact, there was a company IPO'd on the New York Stock Exchange just last year, Globant, which is a tech outsourcing company based in Argentina but serving clients around the world.
And so, since you brought up the election, are you finding that the governments in these countries are friendly to private equity firms? In other words, are they sort of embracing the private equity money with open arms, or is there tension between state-run, state-owned business and private equity business?
So this is my favorite question, and it's why I love what I do, frankly. In Latin America as a region, private equity is seen very positively by policymakers, and there is typically very high-level commitment from the president on down for developing both domestic private equity and venture capital industries and attracting international players into the markets as well. In Mexico, in Colombia, in Chile, in Brazil, in all of those countries, there are government-sponsored fund of funds that actually back managers in that local market. You also have pension funds investing as institutional investors in private equity domestically in Peru, Colombia, Chile, Mexico, and Brazil. And regulation, LAVCA actually publishes a scorecard every other year called the LAVCA Scorecard. It's a benchmark for public policy and regulation specific to private equity on things like taxation of private equity and local pension fund investment, that type of thing. And so the governments in the region will compete among each other to improve their ranking in that scorecard. We sit down regularly with regulators, we're quartered in, and we've heard stories of, from the president or the vice president on down, calls going to large global private equity firms encouraging them to invest in the market. Why? Because private equity is seen as long-term development capital, technology transfer, improves governance and transparency, and family-owned businesses. There's an enormous value add. And these are growth economies, despite the environment that we're in right now. These are growth economies, so it's not about restructuring or downsizing. It's about growing companies and creating new market players.
And how do the return rates or the hurdle rates differ in Latin America than they do, say, among U.S. firms? Are they different? Are the targets different?
We specifically do not look at performance data at LAVCA. I'm familiar with the Cambridge returns. It's very difficult to compare emerging markets to the U.S. or period. So I would think you'd have to look at other emerging markets to be able to make some comparisons there. But like in other parts of the world, you've got a top quartile, and you've got, you know, some outstanding cycles and firms and funds. And then you've got, for example, the situation that we have today, that there were some investments made in Brazil at a very different exchange rate that are going to have a negative effect on returns.
So as you look at the sort of the macro picture again in Latin America over the past few years, as we're standing right now in the beginning of 2016, is it easy for, let's say, U.S. funds to raise money right now from American investors for Latin America?
Great question. We interact with a large community of institutional investors that do due diligence and are looking for that opportunity in Latin America. I really think it depends on the risk appetite. I was having a conversation with the CIO of a large U.S. endowment recently, who had just staked the hottest fund in Latin America last year was actually HIG, raised a really successful pan-regional fund last year for Latin America. And, you know, he wanted to get a larger allocation into that fund. He was looking at other countries in the region, but there was just nervousness among the people that he reported to about taking a larger stake. Again, I think that's where you see the types of long-term investors like sovereign wealth funds and Canadian pension funds extremely bullish because they're not as concerned about things like currency effects. We definitely see institutional investors still going into the region. Again, there was over $7 billion raised for the region last year. I think it's about having the right manager, the right team, the right strategy, and assuming that we're at some sort of a low point in markets like Brazil that will be coming back.
Have we seen some of the currency devaluations scare off U.S. money for Latin America?
Probably. Again, if you're maybe you were already in that fund, no one really. The bottom line is no one saw this coming in terms of the spectacular decrease in the valuation of the real. I mean, it is now down to four. It's at a lower rate than when the currency was created in the early 1980s. I don't think anyone saw that coming. So it's probably scaring more those who currently have exposure to the region and maybe are being a little bit more cautious about further allocations. At the same time, this is the time to get in, right? So that's the play.
So, right. So there's two things going on. Exactly. This is the time to get in. But then if you did, in fact, invest in 2012 or 2013 or 2014, maybe you're stuck. So I'm curious, sort of from a private equity standpoint, you know, how has that affected the holdings of these firms that happen to get in at the wrong time? Are there exit plans or are they just sitting on these assets?
Actually, one of the issues that was raised for us just a couple of days ago with a member firm is that the expectation is private equity firms will be looking to extend the life of those funds. So rather than a 10-year horizon or a 9-year horizon, maybe it's going to be 11, 12-year horizon, which apparently seems to be fairly standard actually in other markets as well. And that, again, justifies firms aggressively putting more money to work today to offset the lower valuations that they were in a few years ago.
Yeah, we've seen that even, I mean, among sort of the higher profile Latin American private equity plays among U.S. firms. Univision comes to mind for me, which was a private equity play. Three large private equity firms bought that in around 2007, and they just keep sitting on it. And now, finally, we might be reaching an IPO, but even that has been delayed again. So it does not surprise me that the horizons have been extended for some of these funds.
I mean, the exit is always the tricky part of the story in Latin America. There are great opportunities. The mid to long-term growth potential across so many sectors is enormous. And it's all about timing. And one of the sound bites we've heard in the past is you exit when the door is open. If you see, for example, I think it was 2013, there were 8 private equity-backed IPOs on Latin American exchanges, 4 in Brazil, 3 in Mexico, and 1 in Chile. There are windows of opportunity, and you need to act very quickly to capitalize on those opportunities.
All right, so last question, Kate. So let's talk about 2016. As you look at 2016 and you look at it relative to years before, are you expecting a big year for private equity funds?
We're hoping to see a lot of deal activity. There's an enormous, again, I mentioned Mexico. The deal numbers for Mexico last year were extremely high. And we've seen, just thinking about the international firms, Blackstone has gone in very proactively, KKR, into Mexico on both energy and infrastructure plays. So we see big international firms going in and doing significant transactions in those markets. I think that will be a major driver. And in Brazil, it's really a question of where is that bottom with the currency and how much money these managers are able to put to work carefully managed, because no one's putting dumb money. The due diligence around deals right now is very, very careful. It's going to be a question of how that plays out.
Kate Ambrose, the President and Executive Director for the Latin American Private Equity and Venture Capital Association. Thanks for joining us, Kate.
Thanks so much, Alec.
So that's it for this episode of Deal of the Week. Hope you enjoyed it. You can expect more Bloomberg reporters and M&A professionals who are doing deals real time. And until then, you can find us on the Bloomberg Terminal and Bloomberg.com, as well as on iTunes, Google Play, or whatever app you use to listen to podcasts. And also, please take a minute to rate and review the show while you're there. Also, follow me on Twitter at Sherman4949, and Matt Monks is at MattMonks123. See you next week.
Put knowledge to work and grow your business with CIT. From transportation to healthcare to manufacturing, CIT offers commercial lending, leasing, and treasury management services for small and middle market businesses. Learn more at CIT.com. Put knowledge to work.